This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. National Federation of Independent Business has reports out. We'll get into those, but let's find out first from Barbara Quant, who is the NFIB State Director here in Indiana, on how Hoosier small businesses are doing as we're still dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. And Barbara, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Oh, hi, Chris. Thank you for having me on.
Well, bring us up to date on some of the latest information that you all have put together from the business people across the Hoosier State, how they're trying to still not only cope with the pandemic, but also try to expand their businesses as well.
Oh, my goodness. Well, some small businesses are doing pretty well. So it depends on what area you are enjoying at the moment, because there are some that are doing very poorly, and we're really worried about them, because our most recent COVID survey came back that 1 in 4 small businesses will no longer be operating in 6 months if they don't get some significant assistance.
Mm-hmm.
Things don't change quickly. That's 1 in 4, and frankly, Chris, I think it's going to be worse than that. I hate to say that, but small business owners are the most optimistic people around, and they tend to hang in there long after others might have thrown in the towel. So I'm concerned. I'm hopeful that things will improve for these folks, but it is still touch and go for many of them.
Mm-hmm. Are they looking at this next round of PPP funding that might help them out if they can apply and get the money?
Oh, absolutely. I think anyone who is ready for that second round, they're applying, and they're working with their banks to do it. Of course, we learned a lot through the last round, and so hopefully the mistakes that occurred last time will not occur, and we'll be able to get some funding to those most in need within a short period of time.
I understand that you've all have discovered in talking with small businesses that you just mentioned here at the start of our conversation about some businesses doing better than others. Which are the businesses that seem to be holding their own and actually are having trouble trying to find positions to fill, getting people to fill the positions that they have out there?
Well, if you're a home builder, if you're in construction, you're probably struggling to keep up at this time. And the biggest problem they have is finding qualified workers or getting materials. There's a shortage of materials out there. So there's delays in getting materials to the job site. So that's they're doing well. If you're in IT, you're probably doing really well. If you had a garden center, you probably had a banner year.
Mm-hmm.
But for those other small businesses, it's a much different story.
I would imagine that you all with the NFIB here in Indiana are very closely watching what the General Assembly is doing this session. There may be some bills that are in the hopper that you all are considering to support, or you are supporting, but I'm sure that you all are watching very closely what lawmakers deal with, since they have a lot of pandemic-related topics that they're taking up this time around. And in particular, I know that the NFIB in Indiana is very concerned about making sure that small businesses don't go under because they're being sued.
That's right. The liability protection for small businesses is critical. And I think there's broad support for this. They may argue about the nuances of the bill, but Senate Bill 1, which shows just the number of it, means it has a high priority. And liability protection has support from Senate leadership and House leadership, and the governor has come out and said that it's an important issue. And it seems to be moving quickly. I personally have testified twice on the issue of liability protection, and so hopefully we'll get something through that will protect a small business, because some of these folks are in such dire straits as it is. The last thing they need is a frivolous lawsuit to be filed against them.
I imagine, too, that they probably have now gotten to the point, if they've been able to cope with the restrictions and the requirements to be able to face all the guidelines from the state as well as the federal government in keeping their businesses safe and keeping their customers safe.
Yes, they're doing everything they can to stay in business and to stay open. And so while it may be a hassle or whatever, they're still going to do whatever they can to protect their employees and their customers. The part of the problem has been that we get more information about the virus, and so some of those regulations and requirements have changed over the period of all these months. And who thought we'd be talking about this now in January of 2021? When you and I first started talking about this, I think it was March.
Yes.
And that had just been the shutdown had begun. And I know when I brought my office to my home, I thought, oh, it'll be a few weeks and then we'll be back as normal. And obviously it hasn't happened that way.
Now, if you will bring us up to date on the national picture with the NFIB Small Business Optimism Index, a new one just came out not long ago for the month of December, I understand. What do the figures show, and is it more indication of how businesses are trying to bounce back after the pandemic really hit hard?
Well, it was not our optimism index basically tanked. Mm-hmm. It went down 5 points. It's in the area of, I think we've been tracking it. They compared it to 1973, and it was, it's a very low reading. I mean, we were at record this time last year, in January of 2020, we were at record high levels with optimism, and most small businesses at that time were looking forward to a big year, one of the best ever. And now we have businesses that, if they're still around, are really struggling. And if you're involved in having anything to do with conventions or trade shows, you have zero business right now.
Does it look that looking to the given the national picture here from the standpoint for Indiana's concerned, does it look like that if things improve on the national picture, that is with the new administration in the White House, the plans that the new administration has to be able to get more people vaccinated against the coronavirus, and hopefully that'll bring more well people back into the marketplace, and businesses will be able to do more?
Well, we can hope. I think mm-hmm. we're all hoping that that this virus begins to subside, and certainly getting people vaccinated is a step in the right direction, and we can look forward to hopefully with the economy beginning to come back, and it's really important for small businesses to be leading that charge, because we have traditionally been the ones to create most of the net new jobs, at least two-thirds, and we employ half of the workers in this country. And so it's vital that small businesses start to come back as soon as possible. So anything that happens to drive COVID away mm-hmm. will be a big sigh of relief.
Now,
I know
every time we talk, we typically like to at least check in on how small businesses are doing. And since we've started our conversation talking about some sad news and how difficult it's been for Indiana small businesses to be able to cope, have you gotten any rays of hope from in some of the comments that have come back to your office on how small businesses in the Hoosier State are doing?
Oh, yes. I mean, just for those that have managed to pivot to do something else. I think small businesses are flexible, if nothing else.
Right.
They're able to move faster. I've spoken with numerous small business owners who've said, "Well, here's an example. I have a gentleman who has had a business dealing with putting snacks and so forth in businesses, in locations the machines that you order.
Oh, yeah, the vending machines. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. Vending machine. And he was basically shut out of that business. Well, he's now learned to be able to butcher meat, and so he's doing that now, learning a new trade in order to be able to still support his family until his other business comes back. So people do what they need to do to stay going, but I'm sure he'd be much rather happy with his 25-year business going strong.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's just hoping that, as you say, that the things will bounce back, that more people will be well and be immunized against the coronavirus, and they'll be able to get back in the stores. And I guess also, for that matter, that the word will get up to the upper levels of government, and particularly to the State House, so that Governor Holcomb can look at the figures and make some determinations that can lessen some of the restrictions.
Yes, and of course, small businesses will continue to do what they need to do to stay open, and hopefully we can do something to help those restaurants and bars. I mean, I don't think I need to remind everybody what's happened to those folks. Mm-hmm. I hear that half of them may be gone at the end of this. So support your local businesses as much as you can. Think about those folks on Main Street, and before you, not that there's anything wrong with Amazon or any of the online marketplaces, but I do it myself. I mean, I have Amazon delivered here all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can purchase it from a local vendor, just think how that might help keep them going until the economy comes back for them.
And it certainly brings very strong sentiments to the phrase "buy local," and we're talking more about the small businesses rather than the big box stores, I guess. Well, Barbara, thank you very much for spending time with us, bringing us the latest updates from how small businesses in Indiana are doing, and we hope to have you back on again soon.
All right, thank you so much, Chris, and maybe I'll have better news next time.
Well, we can only hope. That's true. Barbara Quant is the NFIB State Director here in Indiana. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Coming up later this month will be a major Democratic Party caucus in Lake County to be able to select a new township trustee. To tell us more about it, we have Lake County Democratic Party Chairman Jim Weiser with us. And Jim, thank you for joining us in the program today.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us a little bit first about North Township, some interesting things that maybe residents don't always know about politics, because this doesn't happen very often, does it? There isn't often that you have to fill the vacancy of a township trustee, but you have that opportunity coming up.
Yeah, you're right. It's kind of a rare situation, but of course it's a result of Frank Mervan, who was the North Township trustee, being elected as our new congressman from the 1st District and replacing Pete Biskowski, and therefore his position as North Township trustee needs to be filled. And pursuant to the state statutes, it's the obligation of the eligible Democratic precinct committeeman in the North Township to make that replacement, and it's my obligation as chairman of the party to schedule a caucus for that purpose.
This was a much different situation, I know, than past caucuses and past opportunities to fill a vacancy in a public office because of the coronavirus pandemic. Will you go into a little more detail for us as to, first off, the issues that you and your colleagues with the Lake County Democratic Party faced in trying to get the caucus set up? Once, of course, you knew that Frank Mervan was going to become a member of Congress, and at first of the year, certainly, when he was actually sworn into office.
You know, the COVID-19 executive orders from the governor have placed a number of restrictions on certain events being held. Obviously, it would appear that we're subject in a sense to those guidelines and those orders. So it became quite a challenge to think how to actually physically and practically hold the caucus. And just to explain to the listeners,
mm-hmm.
North Township is comprised of the communities of Whiting, Hammond, East Chicago, Munster, and Highland, the totality of those five communities. And I believe when we, this weekend, we reviewed the eligible precinct list, and I believe there are 142, I think we concluded 142 eligible precinct committeemen that can vote in this caucus. So trying to hold an event with that many people, which exceeds the governor's guidelines, has been challenging, to say the least. But what we have concluded, number one, is that the caucus will be held on Saturday, January 30th. It'll be held at the Hammond Civic Center, and that site was chosen as maybe not only the largest structure in the North Township, but maybe one of the largest structures, if not the largest, to hold folks in all of Lake County.
Right.
And it has separate and distinct rooms, as well as the gymnasium and the balcony and all of that. The complicating factor from my perspective is it's not like a vote for, let's say, a reorganization meeting if we're voting to select the chairman of the party, where the vote doesn't necessarily have to be a secret vote. This, by law, has to be a secret vote. It isn't one we could do by virtually or by Zoom or by Microsoft Teams or something like that.
Right.
It has to be a secret vote. I think we've got a pretty good handle on it now, and right now that's what's going to take place.
What kinds of ideas do you have with knowing that all of that space is available to be able to divide up, in turn have a place for everybody to meet and be able to consider, as they should in secret, who's the new trustee is going to be?
Several of our thoughts are, one, we won't call the actual meeting to order till about 9:30. Mm-hmm. However, we'll start registration at 8 in the morning, and we'll designate which organizations are to come and register at which time. So we will keep it to a minimum amount of people that would be in a queue that would be stacked, so that they could easily socially distance. We'll have them check in. We'll assign them to specific areas separate and distinct from each other, so that there's never more than 20 or 25 people in a given area that, again, will provide for social distancing, masking, all of the requirements that we have to, that I believe are required of us to be in compliance with the governor's orders and the CDC guidelines. And that's pretty much how we will then conduct it.
Mm-hmm. I know usually a caucus is given an opportunity for people who are running for particular seats that will be up for the vote later to kind of talk about themselves, express their views, their, maybe offer up some kind of a platform if they have the time to do so. But with the pandemic, and if you have the have to spread everybody out to be able to consider it, how can you at least give the committee men and women an opportunity to learn more about the candidates who are going to be on the ballot when they consider them, so to speak, on the 30th?
We're working with the IT people in the city of Hammond and our own folks. And the intent is to set up a central area, or a central broadcast area, and then have it arranged kind of in some kind of a fashion where they could make their statements. I could conduct the meeting and they could make their statements, such that everybody would be hearing it by connecting it on a laptop to those various venues in which the committeemen are located.
Might be like a special Zoom meeting where you have everybody together and yourself as the moderator, or at least as the person who's in charge. And this in turn, they might be able to sit on their laptops wherever they may happen to be assigned. They get a chance to see that, and that's their opportunity to kind of understand what the particular candidates have to say.
That's correct.
No doubt, it's the most unusual caucus you probably ever had to conduct as not only the county chairman, but probably involved in Democratic politics.
Yeah, I would have to say that's the case, Chris. Mm-hmm. We're putting a lot of thought into this to do it so that practically everybody has the same opportunity and the same information they would have had if we were all in one all at one venue and at one time. But yet being in compliance with the guidelines that we find and in compliance with the environment in which we find ourselves today. We think we can get it done, and we think we get it done safely and effectively and legally, doing what we intend to do.
And as we know, that there's going to be an opportunity, I guess, until the Wednesday before the Saturday caucus is the deadline to be able to show that you're interested and put your application in?
That's correct. It'll be 72 hours before, and that would be the Wednesday before, so that'd be like the 27th, I guess, of January. They would have that opportunity to file, and it's a very, very important position. I know it isn't always seen as that way, but in terms of the work that the township trustee does in terms of providing for folks in need, folks who need rental assistance or need food assistance, need housing assistance, that's critical. It's a critical position, so there's obviously quite a bit of interest in it.
Well, Jim Weiser, thank you for spending the time explaining things in detail about what's coming up for the January 30th caucus in North Township to choose a new township trustee. And we hope that everything goes well, even though it's a very special and very unusual situation that you all are dealing with this time. The best of luck to all of you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you, Chris.
That's Jim Weiser. He is the Lake County Democratic Party chairman. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There is a new survey that has come out from InvestEd, which is the Indiana-based nonprofit that focuses on offering financial aid literacy and education funding options for Indiana students and their families. And the latest report talks about the fact that there are a big number of Hoosiers that very personally value education beyond high school. Let's find out more about the survey and the results and how it affects Hoosiers and education for young people. Bill Wozniak is the executive director of InvestEd, and he's with us to talk about it. Bill, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Chris, thank you so much for having us.
Tell us more about the survey, how it got set up, and more about the results.
So this is our third annual survey of this type. We reach out to Hoosiers every year about this time of year, and we ask them about education and specifically funding of post-secondary education. And so we're happy to do this survey again, and this is what we did.
How many people did you folks survey to come up with the results this year?
This is over 600, and so we have an entity that does this all the time, and so 604 Indiana residents were surveyed.
What were some of the things that the survey respondents were most concerned about?
So the value of education beyond high school remains very high, almost 9 in 10, 89% have that value, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But then we get to the 77%, almost 8 in 10, that believe the pandemic and the things that have happened over the past year could possibly be pushing higher education further out of reach. So at a time where the value of post-secondary education is observed, there is this fear and concern that maybe the funding of it is even more difficult than it was previously.
Now, speaking about the concern of the cost of having a young person or persons attend college, what did the survey find? How many people are very concerned about how much it costs in student debt that the students are hanging on to these days?
Right. So there were about 3 out of 4, 76% are concerned about that $32,000 average student loan debt by Indiana graduates. We should note that number is not just an Indiana thing. Across the country, there is that amount. But about 3 in 4 concerned about that student loan debt. And so obviously something that people are weighing as they make their determinations.
Did you folks at InvestEd find in helping families and students out trying to deal with student debt and just being able to afford the general cost of higher education that the pandemic made things more difficult for you all to try to be able to help work out these arrangements so that students don't have to pay as much?
Well, what a great question. Yes and no. Mm-hmm. On the no side, we've been able to switch over our resources to virtual, create different platforms, and then have the ongoing things, phone and email and all those things, as normal. The difficulty, though, the yes part of my answer, is that people are very busy with things that maybe weren't as difficult a year ago or 2 years ago. And so as they're dealing with some of the things that the pandemic has made more difficult, and the high schools is a great example, they're trying to get all their classes in virtually. They're trying to handle some of these other hurdles that they didn't have previously. The time squeeze on doing some financial aid literacy, doing some of the things that in the past were definitely easier to do, is more difficult now. So we're adapting, we're switching, and we're adjusting, but there are definitely many things on people's plate right now.
What kind of impact do the right kind of plans that can be done to help students pay for their financial aid and other costs of college, how do they happen to fit in well with communities and having communities participate in finding ways to help young people these days? What did the survey talk about, and what were some of the results?
It was very interesting on the three or four questions that were touching on how students having additional education beyond high school help a community, help a business, even help a region and the state. Very high numbers, about 8 and 10 or better, were saying how if the students and if the workforce has additional education, how it will not only help the worker, the student, but it will help the business, it will help the community, it'll help the town, and it will help the state. And this was very consistently 8 and 10 or better. People made note of this and responded that way in the survey. So it's something that people definitely see and realize how much of an impact it can make.
Now, I know that you folks, a large part of what you do with young people as well as their parents and helping be able to secure money for colleges and the like is taking care of the paperwork and helping take care of the paperwork, at least the FAFSA, which we know is the important paperwork that you file to be able to apply for student federal aid and state aid and the like, is one of your tasks that you do at InvestEd. How does things fit in here as we are approaching Indiana School Choice Week, which is coming up the week of the 24th?
The FAFSA filing across the country is down. And so we have been making the biggest push we've ever made to let schools, to let students, to let families know that this completely free help, expert help is out there. If a family calls us, if a family emails us, they are going to get that FAFSA filed. And I can't stress enough, across the country, FAFSA filing is down. That's no different here in Indiana. The FAFSA filing is down. And so when students come July or August or whenever the education is going to take place, if they don't have that FAFSA done, we don't want students to miss out on some of this grant and scholarship aid that is available. And so this is a very big deal. And again, the help is out there, Chris. This can the filing can happen. They just have to reach out.
Now, if anyone's interested, a family member's interested in getting your help, how can they get hold of InvestEd?
It's as simple as one phone call, 317-715-9007, 317-715-9007. Somebody just calls and says, I want FAFSA help. That's it. It'll begin the process. Someone will either answer or will respond to the voicemail very quickly. Or investedindiana.org, investedindiana.org. There's a contact us page. Somebody can just send an email. Again, all they have to do, Chris, they just have to say, I would like help with the FAFSA or anything like that. We'll get back in touch, and we will make sure that they get that FAFSA filed.
Well, Bill, thank you very much for the information.
Thank you so much, as always, for helping us.
Bill Wozniak is in charge of InvestEd, which is Indiana's only state-based nonprofit financial aid literacy and student loan organization. As far as democratic processes go, the presidential transition is usually largely ceremonial and never really in question. But from President Trump refusing to concede the election to the violent storming of the U.S. Capitol, this year's transition has been anything but that. Gemma McCarlo has a report on a team of researchers at the University of Notre Dame that has been tracking the transition and making their findings available to the public.
There is a body of laws that dictates what has to happen between when a president is elected and when they take office. More importantly, there's a host of democratic norms that, if followed, will make that transition a smooth one. This year, though, many of those norms have been broken.
The Trump administration continues to block a transition to the incoming Biden team.
President Trump on tape pushing Georgia election officials to overturn his defeat.
Thousands storming the Capitol, where a joint session of Congress was debating and working to certify the election as our democracy dictates.
Up till now, everybody has respected the right of the winner of the election to take office and cooperated in that transition. That peaceful transfer of power is actually really, really important for the continued survival and health of American democracy.
That's Bill Kackenmaster. He's a member of the Presidential Transition Index research team at the University of Notre Dame. Each week since the beginning of November, he and five other researchers have combed through federal documents and assessed a list of 46 variables. Those range from office space to training to transition funds, anything that might affect the quality of Biden's transition to the White House. The online report the team publishes every Monday provides a real-time look at how well the transition is going leading up to Inauguration Day. This is a first for the team, creating a data index that the U.S. electorate has never had before.
Nothing in the sense that we are doing has been done before. Our scores are contemporaneous rankings of transition smoothness. It's how smooth the transition is going at any given point in time.
The group also conducts surveys of media experts, former government officials, and other people familiar with the transition. Rachel Gagnon, another researcher on the team, says the survey helps capture less tangible variables, like information sharing or relationship building.
The qualitative study is the effort to bring nuance to each of these variables. Is this actually going to make a more functioning government? Is this going to increase transparency, accountability, all these things that we're really caring about?
It's that nuance that makes the study unique. For example, in the most recent survey, those experts the researchers surveyed perceived Biden's ability to address the COVID-19 pandemic to be negatively impacted by the state of the transition, even though most of the legal requirements for a complete transition had been fulfilled. Survey respondents also expressed concern about how the president's refusal to concede the election might radicalize his followers, foreshadowing the mob at the U.S. Capitol. Gagnon says even in less challenging years, it's important for the public to have that information.
People take this transition time for granted, but people really need to fight for these provisions to be met. This project is just making the data more accessible to the average person who might care about these issues but not know how to read a full law and understand what the law means.
Kackenmaster says without that understanding, the days of letting presidential transitions go unnoticed might be over. He says there's been a marked decline in the quality of American democracy in recent years, making it even more important for the public to advocate for an orderly transition. With that in mind, he hopes this first-of-its-kind index can be used as a baseline to track future presidential transitions and to help measure the health of future American democracies.
The peaceful transfer of power between presidential administrations is one of the hallmarks of American democracy. So it is really important not only to think about this transition, but to look forward into the next transition.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Gemma DiCarlo.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you on Thursday.